as the evidence that challenges it. And an overwhelming majority nationally in the 70-plus percent, and in Texas the numbers are closer to 80%, favor teaching both the strengths and weaknesses of Darwinian evolution when the theory is taught in biology classroom.
So where are we going from here? What do you suppose? Obviously, we had a meeting here of 60 scientists or so. We're not just talking about flakes either. These people are placed in some pretty decent positions.
Well, there was a meeting last fall at University of Southern California called RAPID, Research and Progress in Intelligent Design, and we were very encouraged. There's been some key people in the intelligent design movement, Michael Behe.
Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening a very, very special guest, Jim Mars. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Yeah, Dr. Stan?
Yes, good to have you with us tonight.
Yeah, nice to hear from you.
Well, Jim was working this afternoon unloading big, long cedar poles there, and he had to take a little nap before we came on. But anyway, you feeling better now?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, Jim has written a number of books. Crossfire sold about 1 million copies, and Rule by Secrecy sold, what, about 500,000 copies?
Oh, yeah. Still doing good, too, and mostly by word of mouth. People read it and go, holy cow. I've had so many people tell me, you know, I can't even watch the news anymore in the same way.
Well, why don't we tell them a little bit about your book, the latest book, War on Freedom, which is a story of what led up to 9/11, what happened on 9/11, and the aftermath of that. And Harper Collins was going to go ahead and publish that, too. And then what happened?
Well, they got cold feet, because at this time, everybody was in the heat of the moment. It's all, you can't say anything bad. In fact, you know, the only explanation I actually got from Harper was that they didn't want to offend the families of 9/11 victims. Well, excuse me, that's about the thinnest thing I believe I've ever heard, because there are 600 families of 9/11 victims that are in a billion-dollar lawsuit against the Saudi Arabian government because evidence points to them as being behind it. And, of course, need I add who has been the long-standing close friends and business partners of the Saudis? The Bush family.
Well,
it's really incredible. And the thing is, Dr. Stan, as you well know, my background is as a journalist. I'm just a journalist. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not even a political type person, really. Politics, you know, if everybody agrees that we need a new highway, and then they argue how are we going to pay for that, That's politics, okay? But when we are lied to and people die and attacks are made on this country that we still don't even know for certain who was behind it or what's really going on, that goes beyond politics.
It sure does, and that's why I think that your book is so important. Now, didn't they actually, you had a contract with them, didn't they actually pay you off and give you back the manuscript after signing the contract?
Yeah, that's correct, and which is very telling, because if a book is potentially libelous or is full of errors and wrong information that might could result in legal action, then they often will cancel it, but then they want their money back. They want their advance back, and in this case, they paid me all the money. Just said, go away.
Well, I'm sure glad that they did, but let's get a little into the
background.
Well,
you know, Dr. Stan, that allowed me to go ahead and actually publish this book, and that's why this book is now available off my website, jimmars.com, and I think you can order it through amazon.com.
Well,
that's right, you offer it too.
We offer it as well. So let's get into the background of this book, because people really need to read this book to begin to understand that most of what we believe we know is not true. As we often say, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But what's so very important about your book is that people need to question what happened on September 11th, because that was used by the administration to justify going into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden, only we never tried to get Osama bin Laden.
No, never
and
had.
Then, of course, now that's used to go into Iraq, because, well, I'm not quite sure why we went to Iraq, other than Saddam Hussein wasn't a very good guy, but neither are the Saudis, and neither are the people who run Syria, and neither are a lot of people in Africa, and I certainly don't have any use for Putin at all, or the leaders of communist China. So why? But what happened on 9/11 changed the perception of the American people, and of course got them into a state of mind where they would be willing to go to war. And now the next thing is renewing the draft so that we can take young boys and girls and send them halfway around the world to fight in these of these wars that are being fought for. Well, we're not quite sure why, but we need to find out what really happened on September 11th. So why don't you tell us what you've discovered that the average American has never been told, because of the degree of control that exists over the media, and books like yours are, well, let's put it this way, I wouldn't say they were suppressed. I would say that they paid you off, giving you the manuscript, and hoped you'd go away.
That's right. But this is information that people, if we want to continue to live in a country that we like to think of as free and democratic, we've got to have unfettered access to information. And the information, I'll give you the bottom line of the war on freedom. First off, they have compared 9/11 with Pearl Harbor. And it's a very apropos comparison, but not for the reason most people think. Most people hear that and say, yeah, we were sneak attacked. But no, it's not true. What we now know about Pearl Harbor is that Franklin Roosevelt, George Marshall, a handful of others in Washington knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, and they allowed it to happen to further their own political agenda, which was to get a united America into World War II, something Roosevelt had sought and won an unprecedented fourth term by pledging that he would never take us into war. And then he realized he had to do it, so he conned us by first cutting off the supply of Japan's oil in the summer of 1941, and then when they retaliated and began to send their fleet against Pearl Harbor, he did not alert Pearl Harbor that that was going to happen, even though there is now abundance of information to prove that he had foreknowledge. Same thing on 9/11. It is now clear that just about every intelligence service in the world, including the Israeli Mossad, including the Russians, even the Taliban, were warning us that bin Laden was getting ready to strike. And yet, not only was nothing done, but there was actually measures taken, first in the Clinton administration, and then in the early Bush administration, to actively block any meaningful investigation into Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden.
And I think that's what's really so frightening, is that there were FBI agents who wanted to do the right thing, who knew, had the names given to them, the couple of the hijackers, many weeks ahead of time, and they weren't allowed to try to track them down. They were the ones who were living in Los Angeles with, of all people, an FBI informant. The man's name was, one of the men's name was listed in the telephone book. We could have identified those people. The CIA knew that they were involved with previous terrorist attacks. They were allowed to come into this country. They were funded by the wife of the Saudi ambassador. And, of course, the FBI agent back east literally wept and said, people are going to die. They're going to die. And he's made that statement publicly now.
That's
he pleaded with them to let him investigate, and they wouldn't let him investigate. Now, why would that be unless, of course, they did not want to uncover the plot beforehand?
Exactly. They did not want to do that. And, in fact, you know what? According to a recent article in the London Independent, it says an unprecedented array of U.S. intelligence professionals, diplomats, and former Pentagon officials are now on the record lambasting the Bush administration for lying and dissembling about 9/11 and about our attack on Iraq. You know, and yet, where does that reach the public? It doesn't. The media, the mass media, is so controlled and so under the thumb of the same people who own those media corporations, control the White House and the administration, that we never get to hear any of this stuff. Occasionally it's one person saying something and you go, well, he might be mistaken, he might be a Democrat or something, and yet there's a whole raft of people trying to tell us this stuff. And what I would say, Dan, is why can't people think for themselves?
Well, that's what we do here with Talk Radio, is try to get them to think for themselves. You told a story the other morning when we had you on about somebody who had attended a meeting with Dick Cheney on the morning of the attack, and somebody kept coming in and saying, the plane's 50 miles out and the plane's 30 miles out. What was that story, and where could we verify that? I've never heard
that
story.
Well, that's in the, it's in the congressional report. It's in the, you can look up, The transportation secretary, I think his name is Norman Mineta.
Norman Mineta, right. Is that in that great big thick blue report?
This was his testimony.
Mineta's
testimony.
To the
Joint Congressional Committee looking into 9/11, which, by the way, is now under attack by families of the 9/11 victims because they say that the Bush administration is not cooperating with that investigation.
Now, this is the original, you're talking about this. This is the one that was actually published in December, and then, of course, was finally released in July. That's the one you were speaking to when Mineta testified.
Right, and in testimony back in April, May or June or somewhere like that, you've got Mineta. He's the one who testified that he came to the Bush White House bunker, they called it, or the Situation Room, about 9:20 on the morning of 9/11. And that, of course, Rumsfeld wasn't there, and of course, President Bush is in Florida reading to school children, even after he's been informed that this country's under attack.
Now, this would have been the second plane that crashed 9:03, so
right.
What time was Mineta arrived
right
at the bunker?
After the second plane crashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center.
Right.
But before anything had struck the Pentagon.
Right.
And according to Mineta's testimony, he said a young man kept rushing in to Dick Cheney, and he said, the plane's 50 miles out. And then he rushed back in, he said, the plane's 30 miles out. And he rushed back in, he said, the plane's 20 miles out. And finally he said, do the orders still stand? And Cheney, in kind of an angry voice, said, what makes you think the orders don't stand? And so the guy was chastised, and he goes out. And a short time later, something slammed into the Pentagon, killed some people, and destroyed a section of the wall. Okay, now, my question is, what are these orders? If the orders are to shoot it down, why didn't they shoot it down?
And
we know that they had issued such orders that morning.
But the thing is that there are batteries, there are missile batteries on the Pentagon to protect it from, I mean, this is the center of our military, and there were missile batteries there, and nobody will talk about it, and nobody will ask why those batteries weren't activated that morning when they'd already, of course, had two planes crash into the World Trade Center, and we knew we were under a terrorist attack.
That's right.
Why weren't those missile batteries activated? I know a friend of mine told me, he asked the general about that, and the general said, I'm not allowed to speak on that subject.
That's right. And because this is another Pearl Harbor. And the evidence is quite clear. You can go back to 1995 when the Philippine authorities busted an Al-Qaeda cell there, and on their computers and in their paperwork, they found Operation Bojinka, which was to hijack airliners and crash them into public buildings, okay, into buildings.
And they specifically
so
knew
as far back as 95 that this was the game plan.
But they specifically knew one of those buildings was the World Trade Center, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's amazing. There was even, you know, there's a TV program called The Lone Gunman. It's a spinoff of The X-Files. And early in 2001, January, February, somewhere in there, they actually aired one of the episodes of The Lone Gunman. And in this, terrorists hijacked airliners and crashed them into the World Trade Center. So, I mean, it's not like nobody expected that. They were even writing about that in the science fiction TV script. In fact, one of the students in my classes at the university brought me a card set. These are these cards. It's not like the usual playing cards. This was a world terrorism card set, and you play it. And you play different cards, and they tell you you can do certain things. And it, you know, it's kind of a role playing type game. And these cards were published years ago, and one of them shows a plane crashing into the World Trade Center.
That already tried.
It's not like nobody expected this.
That already tried in 1993 to blow up the World Trade Center, and they knew this was related to Osama bin Laden, because, of course, the man who was the mastermind was a man named Ramzi Yousef at Krafts, who'd been captured in 1995 in Pakistan. And where was he staying? Why, in a house owned by Osama bin Laden.
Of course. So, and the thing is, even in 93, they tried to blame Osama bin Laden for the bombing of the World Trade Center then. But, by the way, there's something, a very important thing people need to realize about the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, that one of the men involved in the bombing, it turns out, was an FBI undercover agent, okay? An informant, okay? And he goes to the FBI and tells them that they're going to blow up the World Trade Center. And he said, this is terrible. He said, I think I can substitute some phony explosives for the explosives they're going to use. And his FBI superiors said, no, don't do that.
Actually, they fired him so that he wasn't there to monitor what happened. And then, of course, Ramzi Yousef built the bomb. So the thing is, why, if the FBI in 1992 knew that they were going to blow up the World Trade Center, and had they succeeded, as Ramzi Yousef expected, they would have killed 250,000 people by toppling one building on the adjacent one.
Right.
Why, if they knew that, and the FBI allowed the attack to take place, why was nobody in the FBI really punished or, censored back in 1993? It was almost as if they wanted it to happen, because
exactly,
they had a man who was in this terrorist movement, and they, of course, fired him when he came and said, they're going to blow up the World Trade Center, and they want me to build a bomb.
That's right. Now, why in the world would that happen? How could anybody let that happen? The evidence on 9/11 is quite clear. They had all the information, all the intelligence was flowing upwards through that pyramid, okay, right up to the very top, that let everybody know what was going to happen, yet it happened anyway, and we're told it was a complete surprise. Well, now, it's absolutely just incredible, but you to understand what's happening, you need to read my book, Rule by Secrecy, and what you'll find out is that there are hidden secret societies who are manipulating or trying to control the entire world, and they concoct events just like this just to manipulate public opinion to achieve their goals. And in this case, the goal was to have a permanent U.S. military presence in the Middle East, something that I remember throughout my whole life. Everybody said, don't do that, don't do that. If we get bogged down in the Middle East and there's a war, we'll get sucked into it, and that's a powder keg, and that's the quickest way to start World War III, is to get embroiled in the Middle East. So we have studiously avoided a permanent U.S. military presence in the Middle East, but now we have it. And we have our pipeline going through Afghanistan and the poppy fields that produce the heroin around the world. They're back in production, okay? Then the oil in Iraq is still flowing. And it's all just bogus, because what is our rationale for invading Iraq? Well, We said we had to have a regime change. We have to get rid of that old bad man, Saddam Hussein. Well, okay, did we get rid of him? Who knows? Where is he? We don't know. Nobody? No, nothing. We don't know where he is. We don't know where Osama bin Laden is. Osama who? Most people have already forgotten about Osama bin Laden, and he's the whole cause celebre for doing this. The other reason, of course, is that we have to, and President Bush reiterated this just a few days ago when he said that basically that it's our job to bring democracy to the Middle East. And yet, look how we're doing this. I've got a dispatch right here in front of me. It says, American soldiers handcuffed and firmly wrapped masking tape around an Iraqi man's mouth after they arrested him for speaking out against occupation troops. And a commanding officer told Reuters News Service at the scene that this man had been detained for making anti-coalition statements. So, hey, wait a minute. I thought we were bringing them democracy, but freedom of speech is not part of that, huh? I mean, what's wrong with people?
Well, our job is to make people think and to try to get them to begin to question what they're being told by the major media in the United States. And, of course, they're going to see this so-called battle back and forth between the liberals and the conservatives, between Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly on one side and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw on the other.
Window dressing.
Window dressing is exactly it, and it's about time people realize that it's all a sham. It's all, of course, symbolism over substance, rhetoric over reality. So it's time the American people begin to understand that they're not getting the truth about why we're in Iraq. We'll be back here in just a moment or two. And our guest is Jim Mars. We'll invite your calls here at 888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Radio Liberty does carry that book called Rule by Secrecy and The War on Freedom. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Jim Mars, and we're talking about his book, War on Freedom. And there's so much material in this book. Let's pick up some of the other stories that you tell. Jim?
Yeah. Well, we also have the story about how that all of the evidence that clearly shows that there was definitely foreknowledge of 9/11 in Israel. There were even messages sent over a Israeli internet service a few hours before, saying stay away from the World Trade Center. Then you had the story that we heard about and then kind of quietly disappeared about the five Israelis who were filming the collapse of the World Trade Center and seemed to be pretty jubilant about it. Well, it turns out that they were part of a 200-person Israeli spy ring operating in the United States. It's come to be known as the art student scandal because a lot of them were posing as art students, and they'd go around and they were visiting military installations and sketching all our defenses and all like that. Now, that in and of itself is maybe not so big a thing, but think about what the media would have said if we had uncovered a 200-man Iraqi spy ring in this country. So there's a disconnect here between what we're being told and what's happening and between who our friends are and who we're told, that we need to support this group over this group. I can't help but go back to, George Washington, who said, make no entangling treaties with anybody. You know, this country, if we're going to be the shining light of democracy and freedom, then we need to be fair and just and equitable in our treatment to every other nation, okay? And if that nation does us wrong, then we could take steps. But otherwise, we should treat people like we want to be treated. If we're upset because there are a percentage of the Iraqi population that are taking pot shots and throwing bombs at our troops every day, why don't we simply stop and think about what would we be doing if an enemy army occupied the United States? What if China sent their whole million-man army, their 15-million-man army or whatever it is over here, and there was Chinese troops in all the major cities? Are we expected just to lay down and take that? Or would we be forming a resistance and throwing bombs at them and sniping at them when we had the chance? I mean, just ask ourselves, what's fair?
Well, I think that there's very little fair about what's going on today. There's the one thing about the situation as far as the Jewish people taking films that morning. Actually, we know the Mossad had warned the United States the attack was coming. They knew the attack was coming, but I think our leaders knew the attack was coming, too.
That's right.
All right, let's go to Jerry calling from Los Angeles. Hi, Jerry. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan.
Speak up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think Jim and you are both missing the bigger picture.
All right. You tell us what the bigger picture is.
The big picture is if Roosevelt hadn't allowed Pearl Harbor, perhaps we would never have entered World War II.
That's right.
And can you imagine a world where the United States didn't enter the World War II and allowed Hitler and, you know, the Emperor of Japan to, you know, they take over the world? I mean, what kind of, I mean, we'd be in a very terrible position.
Wait just a minute, I'll be back in just a minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our caller this evening is Jerry from Los Angeles, and he, of course, is justifying. Will you acknowledge the fact that FDR knew the attack was coming, allowed it to occur, so that he could bring us into World War II to stop Hitler? Would you say that was a fair statement?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. I think so, but I really don't know.
All right, well, I do know because I went back to Yale University and I went through the Sterling Library and I have the pages out of Secretary of War Stimson's diary dated November 25th where he said, we were there at the White House. In fact, this is my newsletter, I think, 2 months ago. We were there at the White House with Admiral Stark and General George Catlin Marshall and Secretary of War, Secretary of the Navy Knox, and the President and myself. And the President said, we're going to be attacked probably next Monday. The question is how we are going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot
right,
and have as little damage to the United States as possible. Let me finish, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we know what happened was that they refused to warn the commanders of Pearl Harbor. They refused to allow them to have access to the Purple Code or the decoding machines. And the warning arrived with a boy on a bicycle about 30 minutes after the attack had begun. We left those boys there to die. But the question is, was this justified?
This
justified? And I'm going to ask Jim
to
tell you what he thinks, and then I'll tell you what I think.
Yeah, let me say this. Jerry, I think you've asked a very good question, and I think there is a definite issue there that, you know, I think it could be argued both ways, and I also appreciate what you said about looking at the larger picture, but I would ask you to look at the even larger picture, because who created Hitler in the first place?
All right, let's Jerry.
Who was Hitler's primary supporter and financier? Fritz Thyssen, the steel magnate, and
right.
he had a bank in this country that was run by Prescott Bush.
Well, you know, if you go down that hall of mirrors,
not a hall of mirrors, it's documented fact.
Right. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I believe
in
that
first place.
Too, but you know, on a political real life basis, I don't think Bush for sure is anywhere near the top of the power structure. He's just a figurehead, just like, you know, basically all of our democracy. But, you know, I think we do have a say. God gave us every government, you know, to do good. You know, every government was created by God to do good.
Why would you say that? Were you going to say
it's
that?
In the Bible.
Wait a minute, Jerry, are you going to say that God created Adolf Hitler to do good?
No, Adolf Hitler was a manifestation of German populace that was humiliated and overtaxed during World War II. So that is the...
Not really, Jerry. Hitler was a military intelligence agent working for the German army
after World War I, who was
funded by the Thule Society, a secret society made up of some of the wealthiest financiers, bankers, and businessmen in Germany, okay?
Right.
There's much more to it than what you're saying.
And I think you're very simplistic, Jerry. I think that what you need to do is read text by Jim Marr's book, Rule by Secrecy, and get in the background of who financed financed Adolf Hitler before the war, during the war. Read Professor Quigley's expose of how there was a close working relationship between the secret society Cecil Rhodes created and Adolf Hitler. In fact, the reason that Hess actually flew to England during the Second World War was to contact the members of the Round Table, which was the front group for Cecil Rhodes' secret society. We not only funded Adolf Hitler before the war, we funded him during the war. He was the best enemy money could buy. But that's why I think that you're wrong. I think that we created Adolf Hitler because we wanted the Second World War, and the purpose behind it was to get the United Nations established so we could begin moving towards the world government. But thanks so much for your call. Okay. And let's go on here with the discussion, because I don't want to get off sidetracked on too much on Pearl Harbor, other than that it's interesting, the similarities.
But 9/11 was another Pearl Harbor. The evidence is quite clear that high officials in Washington knew that we were going to be attacked, and not only did nothing, but actually took steps to block any countermeasures to prevent this thing. Now, and here's the killer. That's the best light you can put on the available information, is that they allowed it to happen. Once you realize that 15 of the 19 identified hijackers were Saudis, and once you understand that the hidden and the controversial parts of this new investigation, congressional investigation into 9/11, clearly points the finger at the Saudis, and that the Saudis appear to be behind, the squarely behind the Al-Qaeda network, and then you realize the close business and social connections with the Bushes, then I think any thinking reasonable person could say, you know, there could be a question here of if they contacted somebody and said, hey, why don't you come attack us?
We'll be right back in just a moment or two. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that we are having a meeting at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, an all-day meeting on the 29th of November, and we're going to be bringing speakers in from other areas, one speaker locally, but the other speakers we're bringing in, because we want you to have a grasp of what's really going on in the world, and, of course, program is going to begin at 8:30 in the morning. I'm the first speaker, and it's going to go till 5 in the evening. I'm the last speaker before the panel. These are people with a great deal of knowledge, and I think you'll learn an awful lot about what's going on if you can make it to our all-day seminar, Radio Liberty Seminar, the 29th of November, there at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. Now, we hope that you'll come. We hope that you'll bring your friends and your family. And we have to know, though, if you're going to be there, because we're going to be serving lunch, and they need to know ahead of time. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Let us know that you're going to be able to make it. And then if you are not from this area, why, we'll send you a map, tell you exactly how to get there, and we'll send you a list of inexpensive motels where you can stay for the overnight. So come, bring your friends, and prepare for an exciting day. And then we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener supported, and if you agree that there's a problem, why, we'd love to hear from you. You could certainly join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and this is how we're able to maintain our coverage out across America, 5 hours every day, and 35 stations on the weekend, and the shortwave and the internet and the satellite connections that we have that has connected us with really the entire world. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family, it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter to know more about what we're about, our October newsletter is a summary of Ron Paul's excellent article, Neocon, A Call to Arms. My November letter, I think you'll find fascinating. It'll be very controversial, but we're going into the rising tide of anti-Semitism that is sweeping across America and the world. And what is the basis of that is many people feel that our government is pro-Zionist. And yet, of course, if you look at the Oslo Accord, where we pressured the Israelis to give up 97% of the land in Israel in return for peace, a promise of peace, and Yasser Arafat turned down that offer of 97% of the land. Well, we're going to tell you in our latest newsletter why Yasser Arafat turned down the offer. You won't hear elsewhere. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just mentioned if you wanted to get a free copy of our newsletter, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Our guest this evening is Jim Mars, and we're talking about his book, War on Freedom, and trying to make the American people realize that September 11th, 2001 was a watershed event for America. Since then, we've had all sorts of legislation passed in America, supposedly to protect us from Islamic terrorism. The USA Patriot Act is going to protect us from Islamic terrorism, and yet there's not one word in that legislation about Islamic terrorism. It's all about taking away your freedoms. It's the legislation they tried to get through back in 1996 after the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, and they couldn't get through, so they just kept it on file, and of course they got this legislation through, and now they're not using it on the Islamic terrorists. They're using it on any American they want to, and that's rather scary. They lied when they put it through, because it was never intended to be used primarily for Islamic terrorism, and the Office of Homeland Security and so many other bits of legislation, each one aimed at undermining the freedom of America. So we've got to go back to September 11th, because September 11th is when it all began, and when the American people's psyche and outlook suddenly changed, and now they were willing to accept increased government control over their lives, willing to give up their individual liberty in the name of security, and now to go to war, and next to send our sons and daughters off to war, because they're talking now about reinstituting the draft. So we have to understand what happened on September 11th. Now, Jim, as you go through your book, you talk about some of the other people who had advanced knowledge. What about the mayor of San Francisco? Did you get into that?
Oh, yes. Willie Brown was scheduled to fly that morning, but he said his security people sent word not to fly that morning. And, you know, that ties in with some other groups, too. For example, Attorney General Ashcroft, in August of 2001, all of a sudden he quit using commercial jetliners, and he would only fly on government chartered planes, as did several of the Pentagon generals. So what? They knew that there was some danger in flying commercially, but they didn't tell us about it. I'll tell you, the whole thing is just unconscionable. It's just absolutely appalling. But you also mentioned something there in talking about your newsletter that I think I need to point out here, because I don't want people to get the idea, because I did bring out, and I write a whole section about the advanced knowledge of the Israelis, and particularly of their intelligence service, the Mossad. And I don't want people to get the idea that I'm blaming the Israelis for the attacks, because personally, I don't believe that's the case. The question is, they obviously had advanced foreknowledge that this attack was going to take place. So the question is, did they warn U.S. government officials? And I'm convinced they did. This was, again, more of the warnings that were sent straight up the chain of command to the very top, and then were either ignored, swept under the rug, or actually blocked from reaching the people that that might have done something about it. So I don't want anybody to say there have been those who, because of the obvious foreknowledge of the Israelis, have argued that the Israelis were behind the attack. But I don't think that's the case, and I don't think you do either, do you?
No, of course not. There is a rising tide of anti-Semitism, and my latest newsletter addresses that and where it's really coming from, who is coordinating it, and why. And I think it's a fascinating, fascinating outlook. Anyway, there is so much that shows that there was advanced knowledge. Do you get at all into Salman Rushdie being notified, I think, about the 6th of September, he wasn't to fly on commercial jets or either in the United States or Canada after that?
Right. Right. And they warned, you know, they told him not to travel.
So they knew something was coming,
of course.
The president knew something was coming, and the most amazing thing is they knew we were about to be attacked. We were on maximum alert that morning, and so the president takes off and goes down to Florida. Do you want to tell the story of what happened that morning? What the president was doing when he knows we're going to be attacked? He knows that they're going to hijack our planes. That much they've admitted. Everything else is top secret because we don't want Osama bin Laden to know what we knew ahead of time. But what happened that morning, and why are so many people rather suspicious that the president was not acting rationally under the circumstances?
Well, simply because that, yes, you're right, the documentation, the evidence clearly shows that they were on a high state of alert, that they sent FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, sent a disaster team into New York City on September the 10th. Okay? So, yes, they were in a high state of readiness, and yet, despite all that, the president goes to Florida for a photo op with some grade school children, okay? Well, that's all right. Let's assume he didn't even know that they were on a high state of alertness, and there he is with the school kids, and then an aide runs in and tells him, whispers in his ear, that the plane has crashed into the World Trade Center, that it was obviously an attack, that this was a hijacked plane, and this is an attack on America. Now, you would think that the president of a country who says we're under attack would quit talking to the school kids and would rush out and try to gain control over the situation and find out what was going on. But Bush sits there for almost 30 minutes still reading from this about a story about a goat. What's that all about? Well, and then the photograph that I've seen of him sitting there with the book, the book's upside down. I don't know what he was reading, unless he can read upside down.
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves, why didn't the president immediately take command? Now, I have read his material. He said as he was walking into the school, he saw on the video a picture of a plane hitting the World Trade Center, and he said, gee, I thought to myself, that fellow must be an awfully poor pilot to fly into the World Trade Center. That had to be, of course, the second plane hitting, because the first plane, the pictures weren't up by that time. So
exactly,
he saw the second plane hit. He goes in, he sits down, he starts to read. Aide comes, whispers in his ear, and says, you know, the second plane has hit the World Trade Center, we're under attack. And he continues reading a book about a goat.
I know it. It's just amazing, isn't it?
Well,
and that's true. That's true. He is on the record of saying he saw the plane hit the building, and yet, as anybody who was watching TV that day knows, they didn't have any photos or tapes of the first plane striking the building until hours later, when some of the bystanders and I think there was a documentary crew there, and you know, they finally made themselves known and finally got to some place and said, we've got some pictures here. But that was hours later, 2 or 3 hours later.
So he sees the second plane hit the World Trade Center, and he doesn't react at all, even though he knows, and he's been told as of the 6th of August, that they're planning on hijacking our planes. The hijackers are planning on hijacking planes. So this is just not a normal response. What about General Meyer, who's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Did you look into that?
Well, specifically, you mean his reaction?
His reaction. I mean, he knows we're under a potential attack. He knows that two planes have crashed, and he goes into a meeting and says, don't bother me for 2 hours?
Yeah.
What sort of rationale is that?
Well, it's kind of like Franklin Roosevelt said when Winston Churchill informed him that Pearl Harbor was going to be the object of the Japanese attack. And Roosevelt, according to an intercepted transatlantic phone call that was made public by the head of the German Gestapo in his debriefing after World War II, he said, well, he said, that's monstrous. He said, but it kind of fits into our purposes, but how am I going to explain that? Why I didn't react to all of this? He said, I guess maybe if I'm out of town and out of contact, what I don't know can't hurt me.
You know, the callous disregard that our leaders have for the lives of our fighting men in the case of Pearl Harbor, or for the victims there at the World Trade Center, the whole story just doesn't make sense.
Well, look at the callous disregard they have for our own fighting men and women. You know, I'm seeing story after story come by here. You know, these are the young men and women who are risking their lives, probably altering their entire lives by serving in the military, supposedly to defend this country, and yet they're sent over to one of the most godforsaken places in the world, Iraq, full of dust, full of burning chemicals, full of depleted uranium shells, everything else. And when they're wounded, when they get sick, what happens? They come back here and then have to pay their own way to get back home. They get in second-rate VA hospitals where they're not getting proper attention. They are charged for their food. The Bush administration has actually cut veterans' benefits at a time when they're trying to call on the young people of this country to go and defend democracy by serving in the armed forces. It's absolutely deplorable. And it did, and it's not just the Bush administration. Back during the Clinton administration, they issued some rulings saying that if any vet, and this is apropos for here close to Veterans Day, if you're a veteran and served in World War II or Korea or Vietnam, and you show up at the VA and you're suffering from emphysema or lung cancer, they now will not treat you because they say that's due to your smoking and that was your own problem. And yet, having been in the Army during Vietnam, they issued you free cigarettes all through those wars. Just think of the old World War II movies. The guy's gut shot, but he says, give me a cigarette. And they do. You know? So they gave cigarettes to these guys all through their military career, and then when they're old and suffering from emphysema, they won't treat them. It's just unconscionable.
Well, I'm very, very concerned about the casualties coming back because I'm hearing the same stories that you are. But you have to understand the government has to economize with the veterans so that they can give the massive payoffs to Bechtel Corporation in Halliburton, which is still paying a salary to Dick Cheney. And one of these days, the American people are going to understand the hypocrisy of what's going on. And I really fear for my country when they suddenly become aware of the fact that they've sacrificed those lives of those buys for absolutely nothing. Or maybe they'll pick up a copy of Woodward and Bernstein's book, The Final Days. I think it's on page 194, where Henry Kissinger talks about our military as stupid, dumb animals to be used for a foreign policy control.
And that
stupid, dumb animals. That's how these people feel, and that's how the administration feels, because they asked Henry Kissinger to come to work for them. That despicable. In fact, despicable is not even a word. It's almost too good to use for that person.
I think all of us stupid, dumb animals need to go down and vote all those idiots out of there.
Well, unfortunately, they give us a choice between Al Gore and Bill George Bush.
You can vote for oil man George Bush, or you can vote for oil man Al Gore.
Right.
So they don't care which one you vote for. You're going to get an oil man anyway.
It's like a choice between being shot and being hung. I don't like either choice.
That's right.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you have a question for Jim Mars, because he has studied very carefully what happened on the 11th of September, 2001. And America will never again be the same. And the only hope that we will ever be able to reclaim our freedom is for enough people to understand that there was adequate foreknowledge of the event that was going to transpire. In fact, I don't know, Jim, if you're aware of that book. It's called See No Evil by Robert Baer. He was a CIA agent. But in the preface to that book, he talks about a reporter he knew who visited with one of the highest officials in the CIA, who told him off the record that when the dust clears after September 11th, the American people will realize that what happened that day was not a failure for our intelligence agencies, but a triumph.
Exactly.
And you might question, how could the death of 3,000 Americans be a triumph? Unless, of course, you understand it was to change America forever.
Well, and you also have to understand that it doubled the CIA's budget. Now, and that's incredible to me, Dr. Stan, because if you were the owner of a big corporation and I was the security chief and I lost valuable assets to the company, I simply ask you, would you fire me and get somebody who can get the job done right, or would you double my salary? Well, in this case, we've doubled their salary. We have rewarded them for the failure that they did, except, as you said, and as that CIA official said, see, from their standpoint, it was not a failure. It was a grand success.
Yes, in fact, the president even congratulated George Tenet for a job well done immediately after the attack. Instead of firing him, why, he congratulated him. Let's go to Ray calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. Question or comment?
Yeah, I just have a question. Mr. Mars, the Carl Cameron reports on Fox Cable, he said that 60 Israeli spies were arrested in the wake of September 11th, and that one group was following Mohammed Atta and lived four doors down from him.
I think that's correct.
This is not in the major media at all, this
of course not.
Anyway, I mean, the Mossad knew exactly what was going to happen. They told America it was going to happen, and our officials refused to do anything to stop it.
Well, you know, Dr. Stan, Al-Qaeda was being tracked in this country by the Israelis. There were 60 spies from Israel that were caught, that were questioned by FBI counterintelligence.
No question.
And some of them said they lived four doors down from Mohammed Atta in Hollywood, Florida.
That's because they were tracking those Al-Qaeda people. Let me tell you something. There's nothing that happens in the Arab world that the Israeli Mossad doesn't know about.
And if you don't think that we were tracking them as well, Ray, I think and I know you're not incredibly naive, I don't mean to insult your intelligence, but how was it that within 2 days of the 9/11 attack that we had no idea was coming because we couldn't infiltrate Islamic movement, we were able to arrest 1,200 Islamic people who were here illegally, and many of them are still under arrest. They've never been tried. They're being kept in prison. We will not try them because, we don't want to bring out anything in the trial to tell how we knew that they were terrorists. They knew who all the people in the cells were, but they did absolutely nothing about them until after 9/11, and that's what's so unconscionable.
Now, here's an even better question that was asked by Karen Brittmeister, who was the widow of one of the 9/11 victims, and when she appeared before Congress, she wanted to know how that if this was such a surprise attack, and that nobody in the administration or government expected this to happen, how come that within 3 or 4 hours of the attack, on the afternoon of 9/11, the FBI was at the restaurants where those identified hijackers ate. They were at the flight schools where they had taken flight lessons. They were combing through all the records. How did they know who they were, and how did they know where to go?
And the figure she used was 2 hours at least. And Ray, if you want to read that, that's my October 2002 newsletter, because the media totally censored her testimony, which was given on the 18th of September 2002 before the investigating committee. So, yes, the Israelis were here. They were tracking it. We were tracking it. And they kept telling us what was going to happen. And for some reason or other, our FBI and CIA refused to do anything to stop the attack.
And the reason for that was that it launched the war on freedom.
Okay, ready to have another...
Just one more final comment. Those four housewives, one of them also asked, why was it that the FBI went to this city in Maine and they went right to the ATM machine to get Mohammed Atta's photograph? And she asked the FBI, how did you know what ATM machine to go to out of all those thousands?
They
never answered her.
Of course they're not going to answer. In fact, one of the things that was brought out in the testimony, and I'm not sure whose testimony it was one of the wives of the victims, and she pointed out that they knew exactly what was said in a conversation on a cell phone a week before the attack. And she questioned, if you didn't know who these people were, how do you know what they said on the cell phone a week before the attack?
Right.
So we're not getting the truth at all. It's about time that you help us get the truth out, Ray.
Okay, thanks for this wonderful show.
Okay, thanks for calling.
And thank you, Ray, for being one of those people who are out there actually thinking about what's going on and saying, but wait a minute, if they said this and it's this, why is that? Thank you for thinking.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And this is really such an important issue, and we hope every one of you out there will want to get Karen Breitweiser's testimony. And my latest, I think the newsletter 2 months ago, was Mindy Kleinberg's testimony before the recent investigation. But all of the significant testimony that is given in open hearings is censored by ABC, CBS, NBC, and the other major news outlets, so you will never hear about it. it unless you go up on the internet. You know who to look for, or you, of course, go to my website. We carry much of this, and certainly one of the. I'm sure, Jim, you probably read Eleanor Hill's testimony before the investigating committee.
Yeah, in fact, I printed excerpts of her scathing letter to the FBI top officials in my book, The War on Freedom. And see, there's another thing. I mean, not only are we have to question about the government's actions and what they're doing, but when I, as a journalist, try to put all this information together under one cover, and so that the average person can have access to all this information, and I have a contract with one of the largest publishers in this country, and then, with no true excuse, they just cancel it. What is that? And then pay me the money to just go away. In other words, it passed the legal review. There was nothing intrinsically wrong with that book. It just, excuse me. Then that should raise warning flags about what's happening with censorship in this country.
Well, I think that anybody who's really analyzed things knows that the CIA and other agencies have their agents planted within the media. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you think that's a ridiculous thing to say, let me suggest you get the book by General Odom, who was in charge of the NSA for many years, his book Fixing Intelligence, and at least two places there he talks about his concern that the CIA, in violation of the law, has their agents planted within the media in the United States. And I think that most of you can suspect what the CIA people in the media are doing. I think that they're manipulating the reality of the American people. Well, Jim, you know, there's so much else. Would you like to cover a little bit about Eleanor Hill's testimony? Because I think that this woman who headed the committee that was invested, this was the Senate, she was the head of the staff for the Senate Select and House Select Committee investigation. She brought up some amazing, amazing issues that were never covered by the media.
Yes.
Do you want to just go into any of that?
Well, let me find this real quick here. Here we go.
Well, I mean, I think that that testimony on itself, she talked about how they knew that the World Trade Center was a target for hijacked airplanes.
Yeah.
And
of course, as you well know, she was the staff director for the Joint House Senate Intelligence Committee, right?
Right.
And she has spoken publicly that there was advance notice of these attacks. It was passed to ranking leaders. Okay? And she noted that in a briefing for senior government officials in July of 2001, specifically warned that Osama bin Laden would launch a significant terrorist attack against the U.S. or Israeli interest in the coming weeks. It said the attack will be spectacular and designed to inflict mass casualties against U.S. facilities or interest. So, hello, and she said she did admit that it was unknown if President Bush received specific information regarding the possibility of airliners being used as flying bombs, because the director of the CIA would not declassify that information.
Well, if there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding it? You would think that if there was any question and it was untrue, the first thing they would do would be declassify the information, clear the air, and everybody would know that the president did not know or that the CIA did not
That's
know
right.
They were planning on using, of course, airliners as bombs. But, of course, back in 1995, that's what Operation Bojanka was really all about. And you know the most amazing thing? Jim, we have in my files an article that was written in July of the year 2001 by Bill Gertz of the Washington Times talking about Operation Bojanka, the plan, of course, to hijack the planes, crash them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the Sears Tower, the Trans-American Building, and I think it was the either the CIA building or the White House, I've forgotten, but those five. And so it was known in 1995, and Bill Gertz wrote an article about that, and it was picked up by the United Airlines flight attendants and put up on their website. Well, anyway, we had that then on September 11th, but about 2 years later when Bill Gertz wrote a book called Breakdown, going into how our intelligence agencies didn't work, and I called him and I congratulated him for the scoop, having said 2 months ahead of time in July of 2001, describing the hijacking of planes and crashing in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And he said, oh, I didn't write that. And I said, I have it right here in my hand. Oh, he said, I was wrong when I wrote that. It was a terrible mistake. Well, why would he make a statement like that when I'm sure, Jim, you know that that was what Operation Bojanka was all about, and Bill Gertz knew when he wrote it, but suddenly everything had changed when he was actually putting this book out. It was almost as if somebody had told him, don't let the American people know the truth. Did you have that feeling?
Yes, absolutely, and yeah, I have that feeling every time I listen to the news. They get a bit of peace, a little bit of this and that, and yet not, they never seem to take the opportunity to say, here's what this means. Now, not only did Eleanor Hill publicly state that, and as the head of this somewhat unusual joint Senate-House committee, she had sifted through 400,000 documents. She knew what she was talking about.
I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought, because we're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the great Northwest. And but we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, and pray for revival, because this is truly a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural and financial and educational battlefield. And then, of course, we ask you to remember my ministry, Radio Liberty. Please pray for our provision and our protection. Is there any way you can come down for our conference there on the 29th of November, 2 days after Thanksgiving? We'd love to see you, an all-day-long conference here. But until tomorrow, we'll be back with you once again. This is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. Well, no, you can go ahead and call if you like to. Our guest this evening is Jim Mars. His book, War on Freedom, it's available through Radio Liberty. His other book, The Rule by Secrecy, is available from Radio Liberty. If you'd like more information, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then Jim has a website. What's the website, Jim?
JimMars.com.
Well, that's not
for 2 hours.
Okay. Well, we were talking a little bit about, of course, Eleanor Hill, who was the director of the staff of the Senate House Select Committee on Intelligence, whose report was published, actually released in July of last year. But Eleanor Hill had a tremendous grasp of what had happened, and she was trying to get this information out, gave great testimony before the committee herself, and then totally blacked out by the media. You can pull it down off the Internet under Eleanor Hill, or, of course, you can get it through Radio Liberty if you want, but people need to see what she said, because she laid the whole story out, didn't she?
That's true. And consider this. Within a week or two of Pearl Harbor, Congress had already constituted a congressional investigation to find out what happened. Of course, in this case, the military came up and said, oh, it was Admiral Kimmel and and General Short, you know, they just were derelict in their duty out there. And those poor men fought it until 1944, towards the end of the war, when another hearing finally exonerated them and said, no, they weren't given all the information. So, you know, stonewalling seems to be the name of the game. Now, after the Kennedy assassination, it was only less than a week when Lyndon Johnson appointed the Whitewash Warren Commission to look into that. The point is that a year after 9/11, there had still been no formal government investigation of what happened. And why? Because Dick Cheney and George Bush kept dragging their feet and saying, we don't need an investigation. It would impede the war against terrorism.
Or would it have exposed what really happened that morning? Because could you imagine what would happen if the American people knew that the government even suspected what was going to happen and did nothing to warn the people in the World Trade Center?
Dr. Monteith, if this conversation that you and I are having right now was simply broadcast on CNN or NBC, there'd probably be a revolution pretty quick. But the problem is they keep it contained because the vast majority of people aren't paying attention. They don't watch the news. Okay? And when they do, they get the pablum spoon-fed to them by the corporate mass media. The very same people who've already raised millions and millions of dollars to put George Bush back in the White House.
Well, that is a frightening thing, and yet when I look at the alternative, which may be either probably Hillary or certainly Wesley Clark, it's sort of like a choice between being shot and being hung, and I don't really like either one of them.
That's right.
And that's really the way it is so often. They control both political parties. They run the people they want on both tickets, and they never give the American people a real chance to pick somebody who would represent their interests.
That's true. In fact, the last person I can recall who might have been just a good old boy, a successful businessman, was my fellow Texan down here.
A tower?
H. Ross Perot.
Oh, Perot, right.
Uh-huh. And all of a sudden it looked like there was a groundswell of support for him, and he was talking against all the jobs moving out of this country and all like that. He was talking pretty straight about a number of things. He was very much down on and very vocal about how that the government and particularly the CIA was behind a lot of the drug smuggling that's going on. And there was a groundswell of public support for him and a growing movement to actually put him in office. And do you remember why he didn't get in office?
Why?
Because he dropped out of the race saying that he and his family had been threatened.
Well, you know, I talked to a gentleman. His name was Chip Tatum. He'd been an assassin for the CIA. And he told me that he was given a contract to kill Ross Perot. He said he wouldn't do it, and he got into real trouble with the government for refusing. And we interviewed him over a period of several months. Since then, he's disappeared, and nobody's ever seen him again. But he told me on this very radio station, he was given a contract by George Herbert Walker Bush to kill Ross Perot when he was looked like he might really be able to do something, and of course change the results of the election.
Well, and that's the way these people operate. There was one senator, Paul Wellstone, right, who actually opposed what we were doing in Afghanistan and Iraq and was calling for stringent and open and objective investigations into 9/11 and what really happened, and whose Senate seat was critical to perhaps the Republicans gaining a majority for the Bush administration, and his plane conveniently crashes.
Well,
even though he had two pilots on board.
Well,
and there was no particular reason, no particular weather circumstances for that to happen. And of course, should I even mention John Kennedy Jr.? And that story about him just losing control and getting lost and spinning into the ocean is totally bogus, because I have the initial press release issued by the Coast Guard, which quoted the FAA as saying that they had last heard from him when he was 13 miles out and on approach to the airport. That means he was inside of the airport and knew where he was and was descending to make a landing. He wasn't lost. And besides that, if he had become lost and couldn't figure out where he was, all he had to do was punch the autopilot button, and that whole plane would have straightened itself out.
Well, there are a lot of these things that happen, but what they do is they give us so much information, conflicting information, and then false information.
That's right.
And by the time that, you know, the people begin to sort of shake their heads, they can't figure out what's going on because they've intentionally confused us.
Exactly.
Well, let's get about to who and where is Osama bin Laden.
Well, I go into a lot about who he is, and who he is simply apparently a fundamentalist Muslim and a man who did not want to see U.S. troops in his own country. And that's when he began to get very active against the United States, was during the first Gulf War, when we began stationing troops in his homeland of Saudi Arabia. But let's go back before that, and we find, and what I detail in my book, Ruled by War and Freedom, is that back in the 80s during the Reagan administration, when, and keep in mind, Reagan got shot. It was George Herbert Walker Bush who was in charge for most of the time. And during that administration, Osama bin Laden, under the name Tim Osman, actually comes into this country, has a meeting with top CIA guys, and it was decided to fund him and to arm him and to create his Al-Qaeda network so that they could go back to Afghanistan and fight our then perceived enemies, the Soviet Russians.
That's really very interesting, because certainly there's been a great deal of evidence to suggest that in July of the year 2001, about 2 months before the 9/11 attack, that bin Laden was in the hospital in Dubai, and he was getting treatment apparently for his renal problems, and he was meeting with a CIA agent. Now, we have those articles out of the India Times and Southeast Asia Times. Are you acquainted with that story?
Absolutely. That's covered in great detail in my book, The War on Freedom. And what my conclusion on that is that that story, it's an either-or situation. Either that story is true, in which case we really need to know that, because that means that he was acting under the supervision and with the acquiescence, at least, of U.S. government officials. Or it's false, in which case we need to know that too, because we need to put aside some of this misinformation and disinformation. So if we're ever going to try to come to a successful view of what the truth is. Now, how do you find the truth? To me, it's pretty simple as an old journalist, okay? You simply send a good seasoned reporter to Dubai, and he goes to the hospital, and he would probably start off by talking to the hospital director, and he would ask him, was Osama bin Laden here in July of 2001? And the director, likely as not, would say, I can't talk about that, okay? Or I can't answer that. Or I'm not going to say anything about that. Or I've been told not to talk about that. Okay, still inconclusive. But then if it was a good reporter, what he does is he goes and talks to the switchboard operators and the groundskeepers and the maintenance people. And he says, was Osama here in the summer of 2001? And if they all say, oh, yes, we all knew about that, then bam, you've got your story, and you know that Osama bin Laden in the summer of 2001 was still being under observation and being aided by the United States government. Okay? Now, if they all collectively say, we don't know what you're talking about, then you know that it is a non-story.
Well, it was really rather interesting. Actually, I think the story was reported by La Figueroa, which is a French newspaper, and the point that they made was that it was very shortly thereafter that one of the Al-Qaeda leaders was arrested because he was going to blow up, I think, the American embassy in Paris, something of the sort.
Uh-huh.
And he said that Osama bin Laden had told him to do it. Now, La Figueroa raised the question, you know, did Osama bin Laden tell this man to blow up the American embassy and then tell the CIA what was going to happen? They raised the question in that article, as I remember it, suggesting that Osama was working at that time with the CIA 2 months before the 9/11 attack. So all we have to do is look and see how time and time and time again our government had the opportunity to take out Osama bin Laden. The Sudanese government offered to turn him over over to us in 1996, I guess it was, and the Clinton administration refused to take him. We had so many opportunities to get him, and certainly when we went into Afghanistan. And yet, of course, our military, and if you read the book we carry called A Crude Politics, written by Paul Sperry, who's the senior reporter for WorldNet Daily in Washington, D.C., Paul Sperry's talked to these people who come back, these Green Berets who wanted to get the wicked Osama bin Laden, and they were ordered not to. So something's wrong with the story.
I have personal knowledge of that, too. I'm in touch with a retired military type who was in some of the most top-secret programs that we have, and he told me that following 9/11, he contacted people within the Pentagon and told them, you know, that he could locate Osama bin Laden, and if they wanted him to, he would take him out. And you know what he was told?
What was he told?
He was told, no, don't do that. We need him.
And I think that's exactly what...
And that's what people need to wake up to. This is all a deal, and we're the ones that are getting the short end of it, you know?
Except our men are dying, and they're dying needlessly. We have an article out of the Washington Times, if any of our listeners would like to see it. It was, of course, published during the Afghan War, where a high Pentagon official said, well, our policy is not Osama bin Laden first. Our policy is Osama bin Laden last. Because after all, if we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify this war in Afghanistan? And that goes right along with what you're saying, Jim. We needed him.
That's right. And the thing is, I don't take any joy in pointing this out. I would love to go back to my 50s attitude that all's right in America and we're God's gift to the world and we're defending democracy all around the planet, but the facts state otherwise.
Jim, I'm glad you're not going back to the 50s, because we need you here getting this information for us, and you have such fascinating information, a great deal of information I haven't read any other place, right here in your book, The War on Freedom, The 9/11 Conspiracy.
Well, you know, as you pointed out, all of this Patriot Act and all of this Homeland Security was rushed through without even Congress reading what they were passing in the heat of the emotions following 9/11, all right? And we were when people, civil libertarians, began to raise some questions going, but wait a minute, this sounds pretty draconian. We were assured that it would only be used to protect us against foreign terrorists. And yet, as you pointed out, and this is so true, they are now using this against American citizens, against petty criminals, against victimless crime committers, against companies that they feel like have done some corrupt thing or another, and so all of a sudden we've pushed this country into an anti-freedom stance, as you well pointed out.
And I think it's so important that the American people understand what's happening before it is them, who is in trouble with the government, or before it's their son or daughter who is drafted. And believe me, the legislation is already in both the House and the Senate to draft your children or your brothers or sisters and send them off to fight in these senseless wars. Well, you know, there's so much. One of the things that's really so disturbing to me is the response of the American people to 9/11. Most of them accept what happened as if they had really, it was as we've been told. There's so few Americans who really have the intelligence to question what we are told by Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Rush Limbaugh. How are we going to get Americans to be concerned? That is the issue that I think we have to dwell upon. How can we get people to begin to do the research to find out, as Ray has, obviously, one of our earlier callers. He's done the research. He's tried to find out what's going on. He knows the individuals and the facts. And, of course, he can communicate this to others. But we need hundreds of thousands of Americans to know what's going on and can spread the word, as you mentioned, your books, Rule by Secrecy, is being circulated and still purchased by word of mouth, person to person, talking about it. How are we going to do the same thing with what happened on 9/11?
Well, you've got to get people concerned, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to your program tonight are concerned, but I'm sure a lot of them are asking the question that I hear all the time, which is, well, gee, I'm just one person. What can I do about this? But Let me just say this. In the history of the world, nothing of any lasting good has been done by a mob or a committee. Okay? It's all been done by individuals. Jesus was just one person. Hitler was one person. Caesar was one person. You know, Joan of Arc was one person. And yet they, you know, shaped and shifted world events. So you never know what kind of effect you're going to have. And even if you're not one of those historical personages, if you stop and think and pray and understand what the truth is, then I think it's incumbent upon you to share that with your friends and neighbors, not in a accusatory, angry, smug and arrogant way, but simply to point out to people. For instance, tomorrow around the water cooler at the office, and if something comes up about Iraq, say, well, I thought we were going in there to bring democracy. So why are we occupying that country and arresting people who are speaking out against our occupation? I mean, isn't speaking out, now if somebody's shooting at us, that's another question. But if somebody's just simply speaking out, isn't that the freedom that we are supposedly bringing them? And also, as you pointed out, and I guess you talked about this earlier, Stan, but, you know, there was a government website that posted saying we need the proper kind of people to go and volunteer for draft board duty, which means, obviously, they're getting ready to reinstitute the draft. They're going to draft people now to go over there and fight in the Middle East. And, of course, once all that hit them, and of course, you didn't hear that through Tom, Peter Jennings or Dan Rather, because it was only reported in the European media. But then it hit the Internet, and there was such a stink that now, I understand, they've taken that notice down from the government website. So, you know, are they getting ready to pull more stuff on us?
Well, I think they may pull that down, but the legislation apparently is already in the House and in the Senate to get that through, but you're not hearing about it.
Of course not, because they cannot stand the light of enlightenment, okay? If you know what they're doing, there would be a groundswell of people saying, no, you can't do that. But they keep us distracted with false issues and phony issues and with entertainment, with celebrities. It's amazing. I remember, you can remember too, Stan, when we were younger, and you'd go to a magazine rack, and it was pretty short, and you could get the sizzly stuff like Police Gazette or something or the National Enquirer, but mostly what you saw was Look and Time and Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, Life Magazine, Collier's. Okay, there was a handful of big major publications, and they covered a wide range of topics, including current events with in-depth articles as to what was actually going on. And now you go and you look, and some of those magazines are still there, but they look more like comic books because it's just lots of open space and big type and short little pithy articles that, you know, about four paragraphs long. And then they're buried in about 18,000 periodicals that are published each month in this country that range from bow hunting elk to snowmobiling to surfing to guitar rock music, you know. And I'm not putting any of that down. If that's your interest, that's fine. But I'm saying that we are distracted from the things that are really and truly meaningful.
I think you're absolutely right. And the other thing is there's information overload. In other words, they funnel so much information into our minds that we are incapable of putting this all into its proper perspective.
That's correct.
And assimilating it all. And I think this is done very intentionally and very purposely by television, by motion pictures, and, of course, by the periodicals you're speaking of. My telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 1-888-464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. One of the things that intrigues me about your book is you have a section in here on the Council on Foreign Relations. You go back to Colonel House. I wonder if that section had anything to do with the fact that HarperCollins did not want to publish this, because you're getting into the Council on Foreign Relations, you're getting very close to the power structure that really rules America. Would you like to tell us a little bit about Colonel House, the CFR, and why you would put that in a book entitled The War on Freedom?
Well, because you can see the hand of the CFR behind everything that's going on. George W. Bush apparently is not a card-carrying member of the Council on Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderbergers, these secretive organizations that make decisions for all of us and are accountable to none of us. And yet he was a member of Skull and Bones. And I think that there's a question right there that we should be asking ourselves. Is it truly proper to have the chief executive of the United States, by all accounts, a member of a secret society that requires a blood oath, of essentially, that you would be more loyal to this secret society than any other oath you take? And that's, you know, in the material about Skull and Bones, that seems to be the case, that you pledge to be a member for life and that your oath to them supersedes any other oath that you will take. And I think there's something that's very wrong in a free and democratic country if the chief executive belongs to a secret society that he won't even speak about, and obviously has taken an oath of allegiance higher to them than to the country.
I agree with you. Of course, we know that his father was a member of the CFR, and
he
was at Bilderberger's Trilateral Commission. He was CIA, Skull and Bones, and of course, George Jr. is simply a member of Skull and Bones. But where does the CFR fit into this? Why is the CFR so important, and what part did Colonel House play in the CFR?
Well, Colonel House, of course, was the man behind Woodrow Wilson. And he was a Texan, actually, lived down in Houston, in that area. And he was also, I believe, a member of the Cecil Rhodes' Roundtables. Is that correct?
I've never actually determined that, but I certainly know that he was very close to these people. And in 1918,
well,
he took the inquiry over to Paris, by the members of the Milner Group at this time, they called themselves the Round Table,
right.
Met, of course, with Colonel House, and they actually decided that America then would pick up the mantle of leadership to create the world government, and they would create new organizations in Europe, in England, and in the Commonwealth countries. It would be called the Royal Institute for International Affairs, and in the United States it would be called the Council on Foreign Relations. So that's that was the relationship between House and the Round Table, and they actually held their meetings, and we actually have information written by people who attended those meetings. So House was very close to the Round Table group.
That's right, and their agenda, which was to create a new world order, and they did that by initially, and House was a big part of this, on behalf of Wilson and Wilson, to create the League of Nations, okay, which was a forerunner of the United Nations. Now, the problem is that the United States Senate said, I don't think we're ready to give up our national sovereignty. And so the League of Nations kind of fell by the wayside. And House and the Milner Group and all of these people who had pushed for the League of Nations at the Versailles Conference then turned and said, well, what we have to do now is convince the American public that it's in their best interest to give up their national sovereignty. And that's when they created the Council on Foreign Relations here and its sister organization, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in Britain. And the original purpose was to condition the American people to accept globalization, or the New World Order, or one world government. And, of course, with World War II, they were able to push this idea along tremendously because of what the United Nations. They got the concept of the United Nations going, and all through the last year or so of the war, the Allies were just about as often referred to as the United Nations as they were the Allies. And afterwards, then, it was no big trick to have a big meeting and decide that we're going to create the United Nations. And, of course, that's been a thorny, controversial issue ever since its inception.
Well, I think that, of course, we're moving very rapidly under United Nations control.
Right.
And what the American people don't understand is that we are actually cutting back on our military bases and cutting back on the number of people in our military. They are eventually, of course, going to do away with our military and merge us, armed forces, into this United Nations Army. We now have the International Court. We have an International Parliament. We have everything in place for a world government. We have all of these rules and regulations to the World Trade Organization and NAFTA, and all of these super national organizations, GATT, and people don't understand the world government is already here. We have signed the Desertification Treaty. It gives the United Nations planning control over 70% of the dry land throughout the entire world.
Right.
We have the Biodiversity Treaty being enacted, even though it wasn't ever signed by the Senate. We have the Kyoto Protocol in part being implemented, even though the Senate has refused to ratify it, because the Senate really is sort of a figurehead for the power elite, and of course these are people who are above the law. They go ahead and carry out their agenda irrespective of the will of our duly elected representatives. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, let me tell you, one of the latest things here is I don't have to remind you or your listeners about the long, many years of contentiousness that's gone on over gun control laws, right? Because most people, certainly a lot of my fellow Texans down here, we understand that if you're not armed, if you don't have arms, then you're just a peasant. Whoever has the arms can come tell you to do whatever they want to tell you, and you don't have much recourse, okay? Because bare hands against an armed person just doesn't work. So there's always been this huge controversy about that, and fortunately for most of the American public seems to understand that the right to bear arms is the bedrock of freedom in this country, and so they haven't made much headway. So now they're making an end run, because now the United Nations is passing laws against the private ownership of firearms, and there is even now a bill in Congress to exempt the United States from these regulations that we have had no hand in voting on.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a few moments with our special guest, Mr. Jim Myers, his book, The War on Freedom of the 9/11 Conspiracy. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listening audience that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon you for your help, for your support, as we reach out 5 hours every day on various radio stations and various networks, trying to get people to understand what's going on. But we are reaching people, ever more people who are telling other people. It's a slow process, but people are beginning to get the picture. In fact, it was so interesting. I did a program, do a program every morning from 7 to 8, and the man who follows me really usually doesn't agree with me. And so I listened in just by accident yesterday to his program, and he was spending his whole program undermining what I'd said the previous hour. And it was really, I thought, well, I must be doing, making at least some impact, that somebody would spend all that time on radio simply to neutralize or to counter what I've said. So we were simply pointed out that there's very little difference between the left and the right. Oh, they sound very different. Yes, they look at one way, we look at another, but both sides are manipulated by the same forces, and the same with the Democrats, Republicans, right and left. It's all this conflict, and out of the conflict comes progress, and out of the progress comes a changed society. Well, this is the time I need to remind our listeners about the conference we're going to be having on the 29th of this month, just about 3 weeks from now. Not even really that long. It's about 17, 18 days from now. It's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. It's going to be an all-day conference. We're going to have lunch there, and you're going to find that it's going to be a tremendous time. We hope you'll be able to make it. We're bringing in some excellent speakers. Joan Paris will be there. Dr. Robert Klink will be there. Bill Saudi will be there. Brad Dacus will be there. I'll be talking. We're going to start at 8:30 in the morning. We're going to go straight through to 5 o'clock with a break for lunch. Hope that you can make it, and we hope very much that you'll bring your friends, you'll tell your family. Bring as many people as you can, but we have to know ahead of time how many people are going to be there so we can order the lunches. And I think you'll find it a fascinating opportunity to come up to speed on exactly what's going on and to begin to make your preparations, because believe me, there are going to be dramatic changes in this country and our financial status. I don't know how many of you know that silver was up 26 cents today. Gold was up almost $10. This suggests to me that we may be on the verge of a dramatic contraction of the value of our currency, which will impact upon everybody in the listening audience who is tied into fixed assets, to pensions, to bonds, to CDs, to annuities, and all of these things we'll be glad to discuss with you. But be sure to come on November 29th. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Jim Morris. His book is The War on Freedom, The 9-1-1 Conspiracy. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, why, give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And the book really covers so many aspects of what's going on today, and a fascinating section here on one of my favorite subjects, the Council on Foreign Relations. And you can't understand anything going on today in America unless you understand the Council on Foreign Relations, who these people are, and you'll find the Secretary of State always comes from this organization. How could that be? I thought we elected our representatives, and you may think you elect your representatives, but the Council on Foreign Relations people are always in place. They're the Secretary of State. They're usually the Secretary of Defense. They always control the CIA. They always control the Federal Reserve Board, and you'll find them in key positions at every level of our government. Well, let's go to Dale, who's calling from Aptos. Hi, Dale. How are you doing?
Hey, pretty good. Working late and listening on the internet, and it seems to be going pretty well.
We got ourselves a new computer, and that's why it's going so well.
Right. But I have a question for Mr. Mars. I heard you mention about Texas, and it's been brought to my attention that there's a lot of different things that go on in Texas. And that you even, in fact, have a president of the Republic of Texas, and how this fits in with what's going on in the rest of the country, if not the world, if you can just highlight a few things for us.
Appreciate. Are you aware of that movement, Jim?
Oh, yes. And, for a long time it was just kind of a joke type thing. And then all of a sudden some people got really serious about it. And then it got infiltrated with people who showed up and caused trouble and then went away, and then they ended up in having a shootout, and then that got discredited and it kind of went away. But I'm telling you, there are serious people down here. This is what is so bad. What they are doing right now is creating such havoc in this country and such dissension by breaking up. You know, everybody's a victim and everybody's a member of some downtrodden group one way or another, whether it's sex, race, religion, you know, whatever, they're getting us so divided that when it comes time to say, oh, we've got to have the United Nations peacekeeping troops to come in and restore order, many, many people will go, well, okay, can't be any worse than what we've got going. And that's a real danger, and nobody seems to pay attention to this. We, instead of concentrating in the media and in our lives about what's different about people, we ought to be concentrating on how similar we are. Most all Americans, regardless of age, race, creed, color, religion, or whatever, what they want is to live a nice, quiet, productive life, enjoy their families, protect their families, feed their families, and, you know, why can't we all just agree to that?
So perhaps while we have our own National Guards and Reserves, well, as I see it, illegally overseas, we could have occupying UN troops in place of National Guard.
That's right, because, see, all it's going to take is for some really tremendous event, like maybe an asteroid strike or a trucker's strike or a huge, they're saying that Yellowstone Park now is showing lots of problems up there, and a lot of it's closed because they say it could have an eruption there, the equivalent of Mount St. Helens. Now, let's say something like that happened, and it blankets the whole country in a sooty cloud, and no plants will grow, and the crops are failing. You could see that, I mean, we're not as solid in a civilization as we would like to think. We're actually pretty precarious. And as you could see, if something like that of that magnitude should happen, or that could open us up, we could suddenly become very weak. Say the grid system goes down. There's all kind of riots in the cities. There's all kinds of problems going on. And then look what we would look like. Look how inviting a target we would be to, say, China, or China with its South American allies. There is a huge Chinese base in Balboa on the western end of the Panama Canal. Mexico, that has its Atlan movement, which they say, well, the whole southwest of the United States was illegally taken from us anyway, so we ought to just take it back. And what if all that turns into all kinds of squabbling and fighting, and you've got militias fighting there, you've got gangs, fighting? It would be the perfect thing, and then all they'd have to do is, and where's the troops, where's the trained military people that are supposed to defend this country? They're off in Kosovo or Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever. So it would be the perfect excuse to call in the United Nations peacekeeping forces. And the beauty of it is that they don't even have to bring them in, because
or even to do an end run around the Posse Comitata, because there's Russian and German troops and who knows what other country that are training here currently.
That's right. They're already here. Russian troops are here. Swedish troops are here. And by the way, they've already made an end run around Posse Comitatus thanks to the long discredited war on drugs. The Posse Comitatus Act was passed about 10 years after the Civil War, 1873, I believe. And what it does is prohibit the military of this country from conducting police duties against the population of this country. And I think it was a sound law if you want to remain free. But they've already bypassed it dozens and dozens of times. The one that immediately comes to my mind is the attack on the Branch Davidians at Waco, Texas. They told them, oh, they've got a drug lab. So they brought in military troops. And who was in command of all that? General Wesley Clark, who they're now talking about being the great savior to be president.
Yet
he sent tanks against American citizens.
I think that's really it's the most amazing phenomenon. If you people are out there reading the newspapers as I do, I read about 5-6 newspapers a day, and in almost every one of those newspapers every day, there's an article about Wesley Clark, who only declared his presidency on September 14th, and yet 5 days later his picture was on the front page of Newsweek magazine. Does anybody think that he is simply a guy who decided to run for the presidency, or is there a force behind him? And I'd like to suggest there is. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a member of the inside group, and they're going to push him as hard as they can for the presidency. I hope they can't sell him to the American people, but the alternative may be Hillary. Maybe I'd rather have Wesley Clark. I don't think I want either one of them.
Or Arnold.
Yeah, and by the way, Senator Orrin Hatch is, I thought I didn't have to worry about Arnold because he's not an American-born citizen, and the Constitution states that you have to be an American-born citizen to hold the office of the president. So I thought, well, we don't have to worry about him, but Senator Orrin Hatch has already suggested altering the Constitution so that Arnold can run for president.
Now, that is a great idea. I mean, here's a man, an ideal role model for every irresponsible young man. We had Bill Clinton on one side, and now we've got Arnold the Groper on the other.
That's right.
Just a quick little note. I've been brought aware of the fact that there's sexual assault that's taking place on the local school campuses, high school notably, and when the issues brought before the principals, and this has been told to me directly by the people that were involved, that the principals will they refuse to do anything. So as I see it, and as they understand it, it's open game on the children there.
Well, if you have a child in your government school, you better get it out, because they really don't stand a chance there. Anyway,
God bless you.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Dale.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Dale, and if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, there's so much in Tex Mar's book, The War on Freedom. You've even got a section there on one of my favorite villains, Henry Kissinger. You want to tell us a little bit why you included Henry in this book of yours?
Well, it was interesting. Isn't it interesting how his name came up? For one thing, anyone who has seriously studied the 9/11 attacks, regardless of what position they want to take on it, if they're a thoughtful person, they realize that the hatred and animosity around the world that has resulted in these attacks on the United States is the direct result of our foreign policy for about the past 30 years, where we've gone into all these other little third world countries and we destroy and subvert, using the CIA, any movement for justice, truth, and democracy, and instead we have installed two-bit dictators and ruling families who control these countries so that we can loot those countries of their mineral resources. That's not some conspiracy theory or some political bombast. That's simply fact, as you well know, Dr. Stan. Now, who was the architect of that foreign policy? Henry Kissinger. And who was it then that George W. Bush turns to originally to head the investigation after they had dragged their feet for about a year, and finally there was so much public pressure that they had to give in and try to come up with some kind of committee, some Warren Commission, to study 9/11, and his choice was Henry Kissinger. Was that not putting the fox in charge of the hen house?
Absolutely. In fact, I was shocked that the president... Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.